is that God has created everything, and the final step of that is that he created Adam and Eve, and he has placed them in a garden that is, in any way you care to look at it, paradise. And one of the remarkable features of that garden is the sheer abundance and variety of fruit trees from which they can eat. So have a look at verse 29, which is the bottom left of page 4. And it says this: "Then God said, I give you every seed-bearing plant on the face of the whole earth, and every tree that has fruit with seed in it. They will be yours for food." So over there is an apple tree, and over there is an orange tree, and over there are bananas, and over there are, come on, help me out, another fruit tree. Pears, okay? And over there are
mangoes.
Good, do they grow trees? I guess they do, yeah. And over there are plums, and you know, the list goes on. And anything that you can think of, it's there. And this is meant to be a picture for us of everything they could have wanted being available for them in plenty. And in the whole of this garden, with every plant-yielding seed, and whether it's wheat or barley or gooseberries and black currants and whatever it is, it was all there for Adam and Eve. God says, you shall have them for food. Help yourselves. This is a whole garden of yes, if I can put it like that. Can I have this? Yes, says God. A whole garden of yes. But then, in chapter 2, we see the one and only no in the whole garden of yes. So in chapter 2, have a look at verses 16 and 17. The Lord commanded the man, "You are free to eat from any tree in the garden, but you must not eat from the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. For when you eat of it, you will surely die." So God says there are all these trees, more than you can count. There's endless variety, they're all for you, apart from this one. There's a whole garden of yes and a single tree of no. Now, hang on a moment, you might be thinking, do I really think that Adam and Eve were real? And what was the issue with this one tree of no and so on? Well, I haven't got time. Actually, I do think Adam and Eve were real, but I've not got time to go into evolution and other questions about the origins of life and so on. But actually, that's not what most matters right now. Because whether you believe that God used evolution to be the process by which he created life, and that Adam was the first creature to have reached the point of being human, whether you believe that or whether you believe in a literal seven-day creation, that's not our big issue right now. We'll talk about that another time. But what matters is what they did. And the issue of the tree is what it stood for. It was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. It was a tree that represented the one who determines what is right and what is wrong, what is good and what is evil. So when Adam and Eve ate of that tree, it wasn't just that they were disobeying God, although that's a huge deal just as it is. No, what they were doing is saying, actually, we want to be God. We want to be in charge. We want to sit on the throne. Eating the fruit of the one tree of no in this whole garden of yes was them rejecting God's rule over them, clambering onto his throne, and helping themselves to his crown, if I can put it like that. So when we come to chapter 3, as Denise read, we see the consequences of that terrible act. And the consequences, really, are broken relationships. Firstly, we see in verse 7 of chapter 3, the broken relationship between Adam and Eve. Have a look at that. Then, so the right-hand column, page 5, a quarter of the way down, verse 7. "Then the eyes of both of them were opened, and they realized that they were naked. So they sewed fig leaves together and made coverings for themselves." The fact that they were naked, and always had been naked, suddenly becomes an issue for them. You see, their nakedness up until that point shows something of the perfect relationship that existed between them. There was nothing that they needed to hide from each other. There was nothing that they were embarrassed about or ashamed of. There was no sense in which they felt vulnerable. Their nakedness is a picture of healthy, loving, trusting, safe love. It always reminds me slightly of a story about Churchill. Apparently Churchill was staying in the White House in America with President Roosevelt. They'd been having talks that ended up with the setting up of the United Nations. And the one thing they hadn't been able to figure out was what to call this thing. And apparently Roosevelt had a kind of brainwave in the middle of the night, said, "Oh, it should be the United Nations," rushed down the corridor, burst into Churchill's room to tell him that, and Churchill was stark naked. And Roosevelt apologised. And apparently Churchill said, I kind of want to try and do the voice, but it won't go well, so I won't. But he said, "The Prime Minister of Great Britain has nothing to hide from the President of the United States." I rather like that, don't you? But it's that picture of there is nothing to hide. Nothing we're ashamed of, nothing we're worried about, nothing that's secret. It's just open. But no sooner had Adam and Eve eaten from that one tree that they were told not to eat of, that suddenly changed. Suddenly they're not comfortable being naked in front of each other. Something of the trust and intimacy and safety had gone. The relationship had started to break down. And the tragedy is that as you read on from that point, the relationship breaks down even further. So bottom of page 5, see what God says to Eve. To the woman he said, "I will greatly increase your pains in childbearing. With pain you will give birth to children." And then listen to this bit. "Your desire will be for your husband, and he will rule over you." Because of what Adam and Eve did, their relationship of perfect trust becomes a relationship of unfulfilled desire on Eve's part and unloving dominance on Adam's. Now this verse is often hugely misunderstood as suggesting that this is God saying that that's how it's meant to be, that men should dominate women. That's completely getting it the wrong way around. What should have been is that man and woman should be able to stand naked before each other without any fear or shame. That's what God created. But because they spoiled it, that's what they lost. And instead it becomes this unequal dominance. So it's not God saying this is how it should be. It's God saying this is what you've made it. And that mistrust and jealousy, that dominance, that becomes the pattern of all human relationships. That's what led to Adam and Eve's first son Cain murdering his brother Abel when we get to chapter 4. And that's what led to Lamech just a few generations later boasting of having killed a man. And as we follow the story, that's what led to Hitler's actions and Saddam Hussein's actions and Vladimir Putin's actions and whatever else it may be that's yet to come. And it's what led to that argument that only you and your spouse know about, or to those power struggles at work, or whatever else it might be. So when we ask ourselves what went wrong, how did we move from God's good creation to a world of war and terrorism that we now see? Well, we see something of the answer here. We live in a world where conflict is rife because the human race has chosen to reject God and we have to live with the consequences. But actually, the breakdown of human relationships isn't the only consequence of Adam and Eve's terrible rebellion. Not only do they have to clothe themselves from each other, but have a look, still in chapter 3, at verses 8 to 10. "Then the man and his wife heard the sound of the Lord of God as he was walking in the garden in the cool of the day, and they hid from the Lord God among the trees of the garden. But the Lord God called to them, 'Where are you?' He answered, 'I heard you in the garden, and I was afraid because I was naked. So I hid.'" So not only is their relationship between each other damaged, but also their relationship with God. Instead of walking with him as they had done, they now hide from him. God and humankind are estranged.
So we started with that question, what went wrong? And we've seen the answer. What went wrong is that the human race turned away from our loving God and have lived with the consequences ever since. But I said we were going to look at this under two headings. What went wrong? And then secondly, what has God done about it? And let's come to that now. And remember that this reading is chosen there as the first of that carol service. It's chosen as the first step on the path that takes us to the birth of Jesus and the salvation that he brought. So God and humankind are estranged, but that is not the end of the story. In chapter 3, we see further consequences of Adam and Eve's rebellion than the ones that I've already mentioned. We see childbirth becoming painful. We see Adam's work becoming difficult. And we see that they will not live forever. But we also see God's ongoing kindness to them. Have a look at verse 21. The Lord God made garments of skin for Adam and his wife and clothed them. This is a picture of God continuing to care and provide for them. Isn't that great? God has not given up on his undeserving people. But there is something even more wonderful in the passage than him providing clothes for them, something a bit better than the leaves that they'd stitched together. Have a look back at verses 14 and 15. So the Lord God said to the serpent, because you have done this, cursed are you above all the livestock and all the wild animals. You will crawl on your belly and you will eat dust all the days of your life. And I will put enmity between you and the woman and between your offspring and hers. He will crush your head and you will strike his heel. So this is God speaking to the serpent, the devil, the one who led Adam and Eve into their sin. And God promises here that there will be a descendant of Eve, and the word for offspring in that passage is singular. So it's not talking about the human race as a whole, it's talking about a particular human that would come. There will be a descendant who will crush the serpent's head, but who will himself be wounded in the process. The promise is that there will come a man who will defeat and destroy Satan and all the evil and darkness and violence in this world, and he would do so by himself being wounded, by himself, we come to see, being killed on a cross. And that man that God promises was born in a stable in Bethlehem 2,000 years ago. A birth we'll be celebrating in however many weeks' time it is, not that many now. Now, of course, Jesus' death 2,000 years ago has not yet brought an end to the war and violence and all the other consequences of the fall. And that's why this reading is only one of nine in the traditional carol service. The unfolding of the story has got a long way to go yet. But what we'll see in these coming weeks as we move on through the story is that that death, all those years ago, has provided the means for reconciliation with God now. Right now, we can enjoy the end of that estrangement. And we can look forward to a new world. This world remade in the future when Jesus, the same Jesus, returns. More of that in the weeks to come in this series. But for now, as I start to draw this to a close, I want to ask us to consider what we will remember, what we will bear in mind when we're confronted with the evil and pain and tragedy of this broken and hurting world. What will we have in mind next Sunday as we think about Remembrance Sunday? What will we have in mind next time we have a stupid argument or are annoyed with someone on the road who has pulled in front of us? Or what will be? What will go through our head at that point? What we need to remember is what has gone wrong with this world. It's the human race's fault. But what has God done about it? Well, he has sent the one that was promised to Adam and Eve to defeat the serpent, to defeat the devil, And he did so at huge cost to himself, so that we can be reconciled to him and we can look forward to a world remade.